This is Audible.
This program contains previously recorded audio from live events. Simon & Schuster Audio presents Year of Yes by Shonda Rhimes. Read by the author. For Harper, Emerson, and Beckett, may every year be a year of yes. May you inherit a future that no longer requires you to be an FOD. And if it is the future, and that hasn't happened yet, go ahead and start the revolution. Mommy says you can. And for Dolores, for giving me permission to start my own private revolution, and for saying yes to showing up every single time I've called your name. You are the FOD within the family. The five of us who came behind you, thank you for creating our second chances. The need for change bulldozed a road down the center of my mind. Maya Angelou. If you want crappy things to stop happening to you, then stop accepting crap and demand something more. Christina Yang, Grey's Anatomy. Hello. I'm old and I like to lie. A disclaimer of sorts. I'm a liar, and I don't care who knows it. I make stuff up all the time. Before you start speculating about my character and my sanity, let me explain myself. I make stuff up because I have to. It's not just something I like to do. I mean, I do like to do it. I thoroughly enjoy making stuff up. Fingers crossed behind my back, flights of fancy make my motor run, shake my groove thing, turn me on. I do like to make stuff up. I love it. It's also kind of ingrained in me. My brain naturally just leans in the direction of half-truths. My brain turns toward fiction, like a flower to the sun, like writing with my right hand. Fabrication is like a bad habit that feels good, easy to pick up, hard to quit. Spinning tall tales, knitting yarns made of stories, is my dirty little vice, and I like it. But it's not just a bad habit. I need to do it. I have to do it. It turns out that making stuff up is a job. For real. Seriously. The very thing that had me on my knees in church during recess reciting the rosary for one nun or another at St. Mary's Catholic School in Park Forest, Illinois, is an actual honest-to-Jesus Mary and Joseph job. Don't tell anyone but my mom. She escaped from Russia. She was engaged to this guy, Vladimir. She had to leave the love of her life behind and everything. It's so sad. And now she has to pretend she's a totally regular American or we could all be killed. Of course I speak Russian. Duh. What? She's Black Russian, stupid. Like White Russian. But Black Russian. Anyway, it doesn't matter what kind of Russian, we can never go there ever. She's a dead woman over there now. For trying to assassinate Leonid Brezhnev. What do you mean, why? Don't you know anything? To stop nuclear winter. To save America. Duh. You'd think I'd get extra credit for knowing who Leonid Brezhnev was. You'd think I'd get bonus points for reading up on Russian politics. You'd think someone would thank me for educating my fellow 10-year-olds about the Cold War. Knees, nuns, church, rosary. I can recite the rosary in my sleep. I have recited the rosary in my sleep. Making stuff up is responsible for that. Making stuff up is responsible for everything. Everything I've done, everything I am, everything I have. Without the tales, the fiction, the stories I've spun, it is highly likely that right now, today, I'd be a very quiet librarian in Ohio. Instead, the figments of my imagination altered whatever downward path the nuns at school expected my life to take. The stuff I made up carried me from the small bedroom I shared with my sister Sandy in the suburbs of Chicago to an Ivy League dorm room in the hills of New Hampshire, and then it took me all the way to Hollywood. My destiny writes squarely on the back of my imagination. The sinful stories that earned me prayer as penance during recess are the same stories that now allow me to buy a bottle of wine plus a steak at the grocery store and not worry about the price. Being able to buy wine and steak and not think about the price is very important to me. It was a goal. Because when I was a struggling graduate student in film school, I often had no money. And so I often had to choose between wine and things like toilet paper. Steak did not even enter the equation. It was wine or toilet paper. Wine or toilet paper. The toilet paper did not always win. Hold on. Did I just see you give me a look? Was that... Did you just judge me? No. You are not about to come up into this book and judge me. That is not how we are going to start off this journey. We are going to ease on down the road. We are in this book together, my friend. So let she who is without wine cast the first stone. Otherwise, sometimes the toilet paper does not win. Sometimes a broke woman needs the red wine more. So you'll have to cut me some slack if I'm unapologetic about my love for the magic of a little bit of fibbing and invention. Because I make stuff up for a living. Imagining is now my job. I write television shows. I make up characters. I create whole worlds in my head. I add words to the lexicon of daily conversation. Maybe you talk about your vajayjay and tell your friend that someone got poked because of my shows. I birth babies. I end lives. I dance it out. I wear the white hat. I operate. I gladiate. I exonerate. I spin yarns and tell tall tales and sit around the campfire. I wrap myself in fiction. Fiction is my job. Fiction is it. Fiction is everything. Fiction is my jam. Yes, I'm a liar. But now I'm a professional liar. Grey's Anatomy was my first real job in television. Having a show I created be my first real TV job meant that I knew nothing about working in TV when I began running my own show. I asked every TV writer I bumped into what this job was like, what being in charge of a season of a network television drama was like. I got loads of great advice, most of which made clear that every show was a very different, specific experience. With one exception, every single writer I met likened writing for television to one thing: laying track for an oncoming speeding train. The story is the track, and you gotta keep laying it down because of the train. The train is production. You keep writing, you keep laying track down, no matter what, because the train of production is coming toward you, no matter what. Every 8 days, the crew needs to begin to prepare a new episode, find locations, build sets, design costumes, find props, plan shots. And every 8 days after that, the crew needs to film a new episode. Every 8 days, 8 days to prep, 8 days to shoot. 8 days, 8 days, 8 days, 8 days. Which means every 8 days that crew needs a brand new script. And my job is to damn well provide them with one. Every 8 days. That train of production is a-coming. Every 8 days that crew on that soundstage better have something to shoot. Because the worst thing you can do is halt or derail a production and cost the studio hundreds of thousands of dollars while everyone waits. That is how you go from being a TV writer to being a failed TV writer. So I learned to lay track quickly, artfully, creatively, but as fast as freaking lightning. Lay some fiction on it, smooth some story into that gap, nail some imagination around those edges. I always feel the heat of the speeding train on the backs of my thighs, on the heels of my feet, on my shoulder blades and elbows, on the seat of my pants as it threatens to run me down. But I don't step back and let the cool wind hit my face as I watch the train speed by. I never step back. Not because I can't. Because I don't want to. That is not the gig. And for me, there is no better gig on the face of the earth. The adrenaline, the rush, I call it the hum. There's a hum that happens inside my head when I hit a certain writing rhythm, a certain speed. When laying track goes from feeling like climbing a mountain on my hands and knees to feeling like flying effortlessly through the air. Like breaking the sound barrier, everything inside me just shifts. I break the writing barrier. And the feeling of laying track changes, transforms, shifts from exertion into exultation. I've gotten good at it, the making stuff up. I could lie in the Olympics. But there's another problem. I am old. Not shake my fist and holler if you run across my lawn, old, and not revered, wrinkled, elder old. I'm not old on the outside. I mean, on the outside, I look good. I look young. I don't look old and probably never will. Seriously, I will never age. Not because I'm a vampire or anything. I will never age because I am my mother's child. My mother looks incredible. At most on a bad day, she looks like a slightly worried 25-year-old who maybe partied a little too hard last night. I mean, the woman is nearing, well, she won't like it if I tell you. So let's just put it this way. My mother has 17 grandchildren and 8 great-grandchildren. When I see her, I like to tell her that she's keeping it tight. Mainly because it appalls her. Also because it makes her laugh. Mostly because we all know it's true. But secretly I say it because it's something of a relief to me. I know I've got that face to look forward to. The women in my family, we've won the genetic lottery. You think I'm kidding? I'm not kidding. When I get older, I will stand in line along with the rest of the women on my mother's side of the family and enjoy the benefits that come with cashing in that winning ticket. Because we didn't just win that lottery. We won the Powerball, baby. All 6 numbers, even the big red one. My aunts, my cousins, my sisters, you should see us all standing around looking like toddlers in tiaras. We women, we descendants of my grandmother, Rosie Lee, we look damn good. Our black don't crack for real. As my sister Sandy and I like to remind each other, we will always be the hottest women in the old folks' home. And that is the thing that is so bittersweet and sad. Because my brain, she is old. Really old. Gumming her food old. So yes, I will be one of the 2 hottest women residing at the Sunset Senior Citizen Center for old folks who don't want to live like Grey Gardens. But while I most certainly will be a belle of that senior ball, I will not remember that I ever thought being hot in an old folks' home was a fun thing to be. I may have won the genetic lottery on the outside, but on the inside, we are choosing between wine and toilet paper up in here, okay? My memory sucks. It's subtle. Perhaps if I didn't spend my entire day needing to express myself, needing to pull words out of my head, I'd never have noticed it. But I do. So I did. Maybe if my first TV show hadn't been a medical show, it sent me screaming to a doctor with hypochondriacal certainties of tumors and diseases every time I sneezed, I would shrug it off as a lack of sleep. But it was, so I can't. Names are forgotten. Details of one event are switched with another. A crazy story I am sure was told by one friend was actually told by someone else. The insides of my brain are a fading photograph, stories and images drifting away to places unknown, leaving patches of nothingness where a name or an event or a location should be. Anyone who has watched Grey's Anatomy knows that I am obsessed with curing Alzheimer's. Anyone who knows me even vaguely knows that my greatest fear is getting Alzheimer's. So I'm absolutely sure I have it. I'm sure I have Alzheimer's. So sure that I take my crappy memory and my shrieking hypochondria to the doctor. I don't have Alzheimer's. Yet. Thank you, universe. You are pretty and smart. So pretty, so smart. I don't have Alzheimer's. I'm just old. Pour one out for my youth. Time is simply not my friend. My memory is ever so slowly being replaced by blank spaces. The details of my life are disappearing. The paintings are being stolen off the walls of my brain. It's exhausting and confusing and sometimes funny and often sad. But I make stuff up for a living. Been doing it all my life, so without ever committing to a plan, without ever actively trying, without even realizing it is going to happen, the storyteller inside me steps forward and solves the problem. My inner liar leaps in to take over my brain and begins to spin the yarns, begins to just fill in the blank spaces, paint over the nothingness, to close the gaps and connect the dots. to lay track for the train that is a-coming no matter what, because that's the gig, baby. Putting fiction on it is where it is at, which leaves me with a conundrum. This book is not fiction. It's not about characters that I made up. It doesn't take place at Seattle Grace or Pope and Associates. It's about me. It takes place in reality. It's supposed to be just the facts. Which means I can't embellish. I can't add a little here or there. I can't put a bit of sparkly ribbon or a handful of glitter on it. I can't create a better ending or insert a more exciting twist. I can't just say screw it and go for the good story and say a rosary later. I can't make stuff up. I need to tell you the truth. All I have to work with is the truth. But it's my truth. And therein lies the problem. You get that, right? So, this is my disclaimer, I suppose. Is every single solitary word of this book true? I hope so. I think so. I believe so. But how in the hell would I remember if it wasn't? I'm old. I like to make stuff up. Okay, it's possible. There could be some track in here. I could have laid track for the train all up in these pages. I didn't mean to. I didn't try to. I don't think I did. But it's possible. I'll say this. This is the truth I remember. The truth as I know it. As much as an old liar can know. I'm doing my best. And so if I didn't get every detail correct, well, once more for the cheap seats, everybody. I'm old, and I like to lie. Prologue, Full Frontal. When it was first suggested to me that I write about this year, my first instinct was to say, no. Writing about myself feels a lot like I have just decided to stand up on a table in a very proper restaurant, raise my dress, and show everyone that I'm not wearing panties. That is to say, it feels shocking. It puts bits of me that I usually keep to myself on display. Naughty bits. Secret bits. See, I am an introvert. Deep. To the bone. My marrow is introvert marrow. My snot is introvert snot. Every cell in my body screams continuously at me with every word I type that writing this book is an unnatural act. A lady never shows her soul outside the boudoir. Showing you a bit of full frontal me makes me nervous and twitchy, like I have a rash in an unfortunate place. Makes me breathe really hard in a weird, panicked, dog-sounding way. It makes me laugh inappropriately in public spaces whenever I think about people reading it. Writing this book makes me uncomfortable. And that, dear reader, is the point. It's the whole thing. Which is why I'm writing it anyway, despite the twitching and the laughing and the breathing. Being too comfortable is what started all of this in the first place. Well, being too comfortable plus hearing six startling words. Plus turkey. Chapter 1. No. You never say yes to anything. Six startling words. That's the beginning. That's the origin of it all. My sister Dolores said six startling words and changed everything. She said six words, and now, as I write this, I have become a different person. You never say yes to anything. She didn't even say the six startling words. She muttered them, really. Her lips barely moving, her eyes fixed intently on the large knife in her hands as she was dicing vegetables at a furious pace, trying to beat the clock. It's November 28th, 2013. Thanksgiving Day morning. So obviously, the stakes are high. Thanksgiving and Christmas have always been my mother's domain. She has ruled our family holidays with flawless perfection. Food always delicious, flowers always fresh, colors coordinated, everything perfect. Last year, my mother announced that she was tired of doing all the work. Yes, she made it look effortless. That did not mean it was effortless. So, still reigning supreme, my mother declared she was abdicating her throne. Now, this morning, is Dolores' first time stepping up to wear the crown. This has made my sister intense and dangerous. She doesn't even bother glancing up at me when she mutters the words. There is no time. Hungry friends and family will bear down on us in less than 3 hours. We have not even reached the turkey basting segment of the cooking process. So unless my sister can kill me, cook me, and serve me with stuffing, gravy, and cranberry sauce, I am not getting her full attention right now. You never say yes to anything. Dolores is the eldest child in our family. I am the youngest. 12 years separate us. That age gap is filled by our brothers and sisters, Elnora, James, Tony, and Sandy. With so many siblings between us growing up, it was easy to feel as though the two of us existed in the same solar system but never visited each other's planets. After all, Dolores was heading off to college as I was entering kindergarten. I have vague childhood memories of her. Dolores cornrowing my hair way too tightly, giving me a braid headache. Dolores teaching my older brothers and sisters how to do this brand new dance called the bump. Dolores walking down the aisle at her wedding, my sister Sandy and me behind her holding up the train of her gown, our father at her side. As a child, she was the role model of the kind of woman I was supposed to grow up to be. As an adult, she was one of my best friends. Most of the important memories of my grown-up life include her. So I suppose it is fitting that she is here now muttering these words at me. It is fitting that right now she's the one both telling me who I am supposed to grow up to be and standing at the center of what will become one of the most important memories of my life. And this moment is important. She doesn't know it. I don't know it. Not right now. Right now, this moment doesn't feel important at all. Right now, this feels like Thanksgiving morning, and she's tired. She got up before dawn to call and remind me to take the 21-pound turkey out of the refrigerator to settle. Then she drove the 4 blocks from her house to mine in order to do all the cooking for our big family dinner. It's not quite 11 a.m., but she's already been at it for hours, chopping, stirring, seasoning. She's working really hard. And I have been watching her. It's not as bad as it sounds. I'm not doing nothing. I'm not useless. I've been handing her things when she asks. Also, I have my 3-month-old daughter strapped to my chest in a baby sling, and my 1.5-year-old daughter on my hip. I've combed my 11-year-old's hair, turned off the TV show she was watching, and forced a book into the child's hands. And we're talking, my sister and I. We're talking, catching up on all the things we have missed since, well, yesterday or maybe the day before. Okay, fine, I'm talking. I'm talking, she's cooking. I'm talking and talking and talking. I have a lot to tell her. I'm listing for her all of the invitations that I've received in the last week or so. Someone wants me to speak at this conference, and someone invited me to go to that fancy party, and I've been invited to travel to such and such country to meet that king or to be on a certain talk show. I list 10 or 11 invitations I received. I tell her about all of them in detail. I will admit to you right now that I toss in a few extra juicy bits, spin a few tails, lay some track. I'm purposely boasting a little bit. I'm trying to get a reaction out of my big sister. I want her to be impressed. I want her to think I'm cool. Look, I was raised in a great family. My parents and siblings have many wonderful qualities. They are universally pretty and smart, and like I said, they all look like fetuses. But the members of my immediate family all share one hugely disgusting criminal flaw. They do not give a crap about my job. At all. None of them. Not a one. They are frankly disturbed that anyone would be impressed by me for any reason. People behaving toward me as though I might be vaguely interesting bewilders them deeply. They stare at one another, baffled, whenever someone treats me as anything other than what they know me to be. Their deeply dorky, overly verbal baby sister. Hollywood is a bizarre place. It's easy to lose touch with reality here. But nothing keeps a person grounded like a host of siblings who, when someone requests your autograph, ask in a truly horrified tone, "Her? Shonda's autograph? Are you sure? Shonda. No, wait, really. Shonda? Shonda Rhimes. Why?" It's super rude, and yet Think of how many bloated egos would be saved if everyone had 5 older brothers and sisters. They love me. A lot. But they are not going to stand for any celebrity VIP crap from the kid in Coke bottle glasses they all saw throw up alphabet soup all over the back porch and then slip face first in the vomit chunks. Which is why, right now, I'm verbally tap dancing around the room, shaking it like I'm competing for a mirror ball trophy. I'm trying to get my sister to show any sign of being impressed, a glimmer that she might think I'm remotely cool. I'm trying to get a reaction from these people I'm related to. Well, it's almost become a game for me. A game I believe that one day I will win. But not today. My sister doesn't even bother to blink in my direction. Instead, impatient, possibly tired, and likely sick of the sound of my voice going on and on about my list of fancy invitations, she cuts me off. Are you going to do any of these things? I pause, a little taken aback. Huh? That's what I say. Huh? These events, these parties, conferences, talk shows, did you say yes to any of them? I stand there for a moment, silent, confused. What is she talking about, say yes? Well, no. I mean, no, I stammer. I can't say, obviously, I said no. I mean, I'm busy. Dolores keeps her head down, keeps chopping. Later, when I think about it, I will realize that she was probably not even listening to me. She was probably thinking about whether or not she had enough cheddar grated for the mac and cheese she had to make next, or deciding how many pies to bake, or wondering how she was going to get out of cooking Thanksgiving dinner next year. But in the moment, I don't get that. In the moment, my sister keeping her head down, it means something. In the moment, my sister keeping her head down feels purposeful, deep, challenging, rude. I have to defend myself. How do I defend myself? What do I... At that exact moment, and this is so fortuitous, I decide the universe loves me. Beckett, the sunny 3-month-old baby strapped to my chest, decides to spit up a geyser of milk that runs down the front of my shirt in a creepy, warm waterfall. On my hip, my prudish 1.5-year-old, the moon to Beckett's son, wrinkles her nose. "I smell something, honey," she tells me. Emerson calls everyone honey. As I nod at her and dab at the smelly hot milk stain, I pause, taking the mess in my arms. And I have my defense. "Beckett, Emerson, I have babies. And Harper, I have a tween. Tweens are delicate flowers. I can't just go places and do things. I have children to take care of." I holler this across the counter in my sister's general direction. "Wait, speaking of taking care of stuff, I also have to take care of a little something called Thursday nights. Ha!" I do a victory shimmy across the kitchen and point at her, gloating. "I also have a job. 2 jobs. Grey's Anatomy and Scandal. 3 children and 2 jobs. I am busy. I'm a mother. I'm a writer. I run shows." Bam. I feel totally triumphant. I'm a mother. A mother, damn it. I have children. 3 children. And I'm running 2 television shows at one time. I have more than 600 crew members depending on me for work. I'm a mother who works. I'm a working mother. Like Beyonce. Yes, exactly like Beyonce. I am bringing home the bacon and frying it up in the pan. It's not an excuse. It's a fact. No one can argue with that. No one can argue with Beyonce. But I forgot that this is Dolores. Dolores can argue with anyone. Dolores puts down her knife. She actually stops cooking and puts down her knife. Then she raises her head to look up at me. My sister, the biggest winner in our family's genetic powerball, is in her 50s. Late 50s. Her sons are grown men with degrees and careers. She has grandchildren. And yet I am often asked if my 57-year-old sister is my child. The horror of it is sometimes too much. So when she raises her head to look at me, she looks more like a saucy 14-year-old than she does my eldest sibling. Her saucy 14-year-old face eyes me. "Shonda." That's all she says. But it's said with such confidence. So I blurt out, "A single mother." Now that is shameless. You and I both know it. Because while the technical definition of single mother fits me, I am a mother, I am single, its cultural and colloquial meaning does not. Trying to appropriate that term as if I'm a struggling mom doing my best to put food on the table makes me an ass. I know it, you know it, and unfortunately, Dolores also knows it. I need to put an end to the conversation. I raise an eyebrow and make my bossy face, the one I make at the office when I need everyone to stop arguing with me. My sister does not give a crap about my bossy face. But she picks up her knife again and goes back to chopping. Wash the celery, she tells me. So I wash celery. Somehow the smell of fresh celery, the motion of the washing, Emerson's joy as she splashes the water over the counter, it all lulls me into a false sense of security. Which is why I am not prepared. I turn, hand her the wet, clean celery, and I'm surprised when, still chopping, Dolores begins to speak. You're a single mother, but you are not a single mother. I live 4 blocks away. Sandy lives 4 blocks away. Your parents live 40 minutes away and would love to stay with the kids. You have literally the best nanny in the world. You have 3 amazing best friends who would step in and help at any time. You are surrounded by family and friends who love you, people who want you to be happy. You are your own boss. Your job is only as busy as you make it. But you never do anything but work. You never have any fun. You used to have so much fun. Now all these amazing opportunities are coming your way, once-in-a-lifetime opportunities, and you aren't taking advantage of any of them. Why? I shift, uncomfortable. For some reason, I do not like this. I do not like anything about this conversation at all. My life is fine. My life is great. I mean, look around. Look. I'm happy-ish. I'm happy-ish. Kind of. Mind your own business, Dolores. You are annoying, Dolores. People aren't supposed to Benjamin Button, so your face is clearly the result of a pact with Satan, Dolores. You know what, Dolores? You smell like poop. But I don't say any of that. Instead, I stand there for a long time watching her chop. And finally, I answer, putting just the right amount of casual arrogance in my voice. Whatever. And then I turn away, hoping to indicate that the conversation is over. I head over to the sitting area, where I gently settle an already napping Beckett into the bassinet. I place Emerson on the changing table for a fresh diaper. In a moment, I'll go upstairs and try to find a spit-up-free shirt to wear for dinner. The fresh diaper is on. I put Emerson on my hip, lay her head on my shoulder, and we swing back around to face my sister as I head for the stairs. That's when she says it, the 6 words, mutters them, almost under her breath, as she finishes chopping the onions. 6 startling words. You never say yes to anything. For a single beat, time stops. Becomes a clear, frozen moment I'll never forget. One of the paintings that will never be taken from my mental wall. My sister, in a brown hoodie, her hair in a neat knot at the nape of her neck, standing there with that knife in her hand, head down, a little pile of white onion pieces on the cutting board before her. She tosses the words out there. You never say yes to anything. Tosses the words out there like a grenade. You never say yes to anything. Then my sister slides the onions over and begins chopping the celery. I head upstairs to change my shirt. Family and friends arrive. The turkey cooks perfectly. Dinner is delicious. The grenade lies there in the middle of everything, quiet, camouflaged. I don't think about it. You never say yes to anything. Thanksgiving Day comes and goes. Chapter 2. Maybe? The grenade sits dormant for several weeks. It rolls around in my brain, the safety clip firmly in place, so quietly stealthy that I am able to forget it is there. I maintain my usual routine. I go to work. I write scripts, I work on episodes of TV, I come home, I snuggle babies, I read bedtime stories. Life is normal. One single out-of-the-ordinary event occurs. I fly to Washington as a new trustee of the Kennedy Center. I attend the celebrations, making my first trip to the White House. And then, for magical reasons that to this day I still don't understand, I am told I will be sitting with the president and the First Lady in their box at the Kennedy Center Honors. I am not asked. I am told. I am not given a chance to say no. mainly because I'm sure it never occurs to anyone that I would decline such an honor. Who would? I wear a very beautiful black beaded evening gown. My date wears a new tuxedo. We sit right behind President and Mrs. Obama for the entirety of the ceremony. I am much too shy and nervous to croak out more than a few words when faced with a chance to speak to the actual President and First Lady. I certainly don't form sentences. But I enjoy myself. I have fun. We drink cocktails in the same room as Carlos Santana and Shirley MacLaine. We get the street cred to be able to say we were there when Snoop Dogg thanked Herbie Hancock for creating hip-hop. We see Garth Brooks sing Billy Joel's Goodnight Saigon with a choir made up of veterans. It's amazing. The whole evening feels a bit enchanted. No matter how cynical the Beltway thinks it is or how world-weary politicians may seem, D.C. is a town that lacks the true cynicism of Hollywood. People actually get excited about things there, and the enthusiasm is infectious. I fly back to Los Angeles with a buoyant sense of optimism. The grenade explodes without warning. It happens at 4 a.m, a few days before Christmas. I'm flat on my back in the middle of my king-size bed, eyes pulled open against my will. Something snapped me awake, yanked me out of sleep. Being woken abruptly is not new. Like every other mother on the planet, from the moment my first baby entered the house, I stopped getting real sleep. Motherhood means I'm always a little bit awake, a little bit alert at all times, one eye open. So being awakened by something in the middle of the night isn't surprising. What is surprising is that this something doesn't have anything to do with a furious kid standing in a crib screaming her head off. The house is silent. My girls are fast asleep. So why am I awake? If they had asked me, I would have said no. That thought makes me sit up in bed. What? If they had asked me, I would have said no. My face gets hot. I'm embarrassed, as if there's someone else in the room hearing the words inside my brain. If they had asked me if I wanted to sit in the presidential box at the Kennedy Center Honors, I would have said no. Ridiculous. But it's true. It's clearly true. I am as sure of this as I am of the need to breathe. I would have said no carefully, respectfully, graciously. I would have come up with a creative excuse, expressed both extreme honor and regret. The excuse would have been good. The excuse would have been brilliant. I mean, come on. I'm a writer. I would have been eloquent and delightful. No one can decline an invitation as beautifully as I can. You're all amateurs at bailing on something. I bail on events so well that I could do it in the major leagues. I nod to myself certain. However I handled it, I definitely would have said no. That is an unquestionable fact. If they had asked, I would have said no. Seriously? I am up and out of bed. Sleep doesn't have a chance now. This requires thought. This requires wine. Downstairs, I throw myself on my sofa and stare at the lights of my Christmas tree. Glass of wine in hand, I drink about the question. Why would I have said no? But I know the answer. I knew the answer before I got out of bed. I just wanted the wine. Because it's scary. I would have said no to sitting in the presidential box at the Kennedy Center with POTUS and FLOTUS because the prospect of saying yes was terrifying to me. I would have said no because if I had said yes, I would have had to actually do it. I would have had to actually go and sit in the box and be there to meet the president and the first lady. I would have had to make small talk and say things. I would have had to drink cocktails near Carlos Santana. I would have had to do all the things that I, in fact, did do that night. And I had a wonderful time. When all was said and done, it was one of the most memorable nights of my life. Look, I am known for giving good story. The kind of good story told over dinner that makes my friends laugh. That gets my date to accidentally spit his cocktail across a table. The kind of good story that has everyone asking me to tell that one again. That's my superpower. Telling good stories. Smooth stories. Funny stories. Epic stories. I can make any story good. I can take the lamest tale and make it compelling. The thing is, a good story is not about purposely lying. The best stories are true. Giving good story just requires that I leave out the untidy bits. The bits where, before I leave for the White House, I spend 10 minutes convincing myself that I do not have the stomach flu, that I am fine. Where I consider licking the dust at the bottom of the Xanax bottle because, oh yeah, I don't take Xanax anymore. It's been 12 years since Xanax was my friend. Yuck, this Xanax dust is 12-year-old Xanax dust? Where I sleep for 14 hours straight because I'm so numb with stress that it's either sleep or run. And I don't mean jog on a treadmill, I mean run. I mean get in a car, go to the airport, get on a plane, and run away. Run. That seems like a much better plan than going out in public with every nerve ending in my body screaming. This is who I am. Silent. Quiet. Interior. More comfortable with books than new situations. Content to live within my imagination. I've lived inside my head since I was a kid. My earliest memories are of sitting on the floor of the kitchen pantry. I stayed there for hours in the darkness and warmth, playing with a kingdom I created out of the canned goods. I was not an unhappy kid. Because I was the baby in a family of eight, at any given moment someone was available to read to me, applaud whatever story I had come up with, or let me listen in on their teenage secrets. The end to every sibling argument over the extra cookie and the last slice of cake was always an egalitarian sigh. Give it to the baby. I was loved. I was a star. I was the blue ivy of my world. I was not an unhappy kid. I was just an unusual kid. Lucky for me, my parents held unusual in high regard. And so, when I wanted to play with the cans in the pantry for hours on end, my mother didn't tell me to stop messing around with the food and go somewhere else to play. Instead, she declared it a sign of creativity, closed the pantry door, and let me be. You have her to thank for my love of long-form serialized drama. The world I created inside the small closet filled with canned goods and cereal was serious. These days I would describe it as a winter is coming, where are my dragons kind of solo playdate, but this was not HBO. This was the suburbs in the 1970s. We didn't need reality TV because TV was real. Nixon was going down. As Watergate played out on the tiny black and white set my mother had dragged into the kitchen and balanced on a chair just outside the pantry doors, my 3-year-old imagination made a world of its own. The big cans of yams ruled over the peas and green beans while the tiny citizens of tomato paste land planned a revolution designed to overthrow the government. There were hearings and failed assassination attempts and resignations. Every once in a while, my mom would open the pantry door, flooding my world with light. She'd politely tell me she needed vegetables for dinner. The canned judiciary would sentence a can of corn to death for treason, and I'd deliver the guilty party into the hands of the executioner. Man, that pantry was fun. You see the problem? Did you hear the problem? Man, that pantry was fun. That just came out of my mouth. And I actually said it aloud while I typed it. And I said it without irony. I said it with a big, dorky, wistful grin on my face. I had a wonderful childhood, but I lived so deep in my imagination that I was happier and more at home in that pantry with the canned goods than I ever was with people. I felt safer in that pantry, freer in that pantry. True when I was 3 years old, and somehow even more true at 43. As I sit on my sofa staring into the Christmas lights, I realize that I would still be partying in my pantry if I thought I could get away with it, if I didn't have children who needed me to be in the world. I fight the instinct every day, which is why I now have a garden for vegetables. If they had asked me, I would have said no. I would have said no, because I always say no. And that's when the grenade explodes. Suddenly, it's Thanksgiving, and I'm back in that kitchen, covered in spit up, watching my sister chop those onions, and I understand her now. You never say yes to anything. I don't just understand her. I believe her. I hear her. And I know she is right. Boom. Grenade. When the dust settles and everything is clear, I am left with one thought rattling through my head. I'm miserable. That makes me put down my wine glass. Am I drunk? Am I kidding me? Did I just think that? Honestly, I'm a little indignant with myself. I'm embarrassed to even be having that thought. I'm ashamed, if you really want to know. I'm bathed in shame. I'm miserable? I'm still a little ashamed to be telling you that right now. I'm miserable. Who in the hell do I think I am? A whiner. That's who. A great big old whiner person. You know who gets to be miserable? Malala. Because someone shot her in the face. You know who else? The Chibok schoolgirls. Because the terrorist group Boko Haram kidnapped them from school for forced marriage, which is just like regular marriage, except exactly the opposite and full of rape, and no one cares anymore. You know who else? Anne Frank. Because she and about 6 million other Jewish people were murdered by the Nazis. And Mother Teresa. Because everyone else was too lazy to treat the lepers, and so she had to do it. It's pretty shameful of me to sit around saying I'm miserable when there are no bullets in my face and no one's kidnapped me or killed me or left me alone to treat all the lepers. I grew up in a family where hard work was not optional. My parents worked very hard to raise and educate six, count them, six children. And at some point, it dawned on me that the reason I had such a great childhood and never wanted for anything was because my parents worked extremely hard so we could have crazy things like food and gas and clothes and tuition. In high school, I got a job scooping ice cream at Baskin-Robbins, and I have had a job ever since. So I am very aware that these days I live in a rarefied world. I know that I am extremely fortunate. I know that I have incredible children, a fantastic family, great friends, a spectacular job, a lovely home, and all my arms, legs, fingers, toes, and organs intact. I know I don't have the right to complain. Not about my life in comparison to anyone else's, unless that anyone is Beyoncé. Damn, my life is so bad next to Beyoncé's life. So is yours. Everyone's life is so bad next to hers. If you know otherwise, if you know that Beyoncé's life is terrible for some reason, please do not come up to me on the street and correct me. I need to believe that Beyoncé's life is perfect. It keeps me going. But except for Beyoncé, I know how fortunate I am. I have no delusions that I am suffering in any real true way. And so it does embarrass me to say it. I mean, you don't hear Malala complaining. But you know why you don't hear Malala complaining? Because Malala and her spiritual buddies, Mother Teresa and Anne Frank, are all much better people than I am. Obviously. Because I'm clearly a giant whining baby and I suck. Because in that pre-dawn, staring at my Christmas lights, even though I am ashamed, I cannot avoid it. The realization feels like plunging into an icy lake. I am miserable. Admitting this takes my breath away. I feel as though I am revealing new information to myself, learning a secret I have been keeping from myself. I am miserable, truly, deeply unhappy. In December 2013, I was incredibly successful. I had two hugely popular television shows on the air, Grey's Anatomy and Scandal, and had just retired a third, Private Practice. My company, Shondaland, was in the midst of working with writer Peter Nowak to develop a show that would soon become our newest hit, How to Get Away with Murder. So yeah, from the outside, I think everything probably looked great. As long as I was writing, as long as my fingers were on the keyboard, as long as I was at Seattle Grace or Pope and Associates, as long as I was laying track and feeling the hum in my brain, I was fine. I was happy. I know that I certainly tried to project the idea that my life was perfect, and I tried not to think about it too hard. I went to work. I worked a lot. I came home. I spent some time with my kids. I spent some time with the guy I was dating. I slept. That's it. In public, I smiled a lot. I did a huge amount of smiling. And I did what I called athlete talk. Athlete talk is what happens on all those interviews that take place right after any pro sports event you see on TV. A boxing match or an NBA game. Serena Williams smashing some record in tennis. Olympic swimming. Good athlete talk is when the athlete goes before the press and keeps a smile on her face, voice bland and pleasant as she deftly fields one reporter's question after the other, never once saying anything of controversy or substance. My favorite athlete talker of all time is Michael Jordan. He'd stand there after scoring 5,635 points in one game, sweat pouring down his head, towering over some tiny reporter. "I'm just happy to be playing the game of basketball," he'd say, smiling. "But Michael, how do you feel about famine, politics, the WNBA, cartoons, Hanes underwear, tacos, anything?" "I'm thrilled to do what I can for the ball club. The Bulls are home to me," he'd chuckle pleasantly. And then he'd amble away, presumably to the locker room, where he stopped being a good athlete talker and started being a person. I was a good athlete talker that year. I am just happy to be working for ABC. It's not my job to question my time slot. My job is to make the shows. I'm proud to be part of the ABC team. I'm thrilled to do what I can for the network. ABC is home to me. I'm just happy to be playing the game of basketball. Writing for TV. And it was true. I was happy and proud and thrilled. I did like ABC. I still do. Hello, ABC. Just as I'm sure Michael truly liked the Bulls. But that athlete talk didn't have anything to do with liking my job. It had to do with staying inside the pantry. Keeping that door shut, hearing Nixon on the outside. Only reaching one arm out into the sliver of light to hand out peas or corn or yams. Giving the people what they wanted, then closing that door again. Any actual parts of me, anything real, anything human, anything honest, I kept to myself. I was a very good girl. I did what everyone needed me to do. And at the end of every day, as a reward, I poured myself a glass of red wine. Red wine was joy in Shondaland. I used to be a really happy person, a vibrant person. I may have been shy and introverted, but I had a rowdy, fun crowd of friends, some of whom I'd known since college, and with them around me, I was dance on the table, Shonda. Drive to New Orleans at a moment's notice, Shonda. Adventurous and always up for anything, Shonda. Where did she go? I had no real way to account for my unhappiness. For once, the storyteller had nothing to tell. I had no idea why I was unhappy, no specific moment or reason to point to. I just knew it was true. Whatever that spark is that makes each one of us alive and unique, mine had gone. Stolen like the paintings on the wall. The flickering flame responsible for lighting me up from the inside, making me glow, keeping me warm. My candle had been blown out. I was shut down. I was tired. I was afraid. Small. Quiet. The lives of my characters had become unimaginably huge. People all over the world knew Meredith and Olivia. At the same time, my life had so drained of color and excitement that I could barely see it. Why? You never say yes to anything. Oh, yeah. That. I put down the glass of wine and lay on the sofa and really thought about those six words. You never say yes to anything. Maybe it was time to start saying yes. Maybe. Chapter 3. Yes? January 13th is my birthday. Yippee. I love birthdays because I love birthday parties. When I found out there was something called a puppy party, where they bring puppies for kids to hold and cuddle for an hour, and it's not puppy abuse, it's good for puppies because they are training the puppies to be service dogs. I almost lost my mind jumping up and down. Puppies, a party with puppies, come on, that exists. I like puppy parties and face painters and candy buffets and that guy with a guitar singing silly songs and ice cream and even some, very few, non-scary clowns. And if you are past the age where helium balloons and face painting get you so excited and or terrified that there's a danger you will pee your pants, I like dance parties and costume parties and dinner parties and 70s disco parties. I am a firm believer that parties make everything better. You'd think a shy person would hate birthday parties. I love them. Small parties and big parties, I don't necessarily love to attend them, but I love the magic of them. I love the idea of them. I love to hug the corners of the walls and watch the good times. I love being with friends. But today, this birthday, I get out of the shower and lean really close to the bathroom mirror so I can see all of my pores. Then I glare at my face. So you made it out of a uterus a long time ago. Big deal, I whisper. So did everybody else on the planet. What else you got? Then I think about going back to bed. Really, I usually love my birthday. I do. But today I am nervous, edgy. I feel prickly and strange, like everyone is looking at me. I'm unnerved. There's a pit of something odd in my stomach. It's the same feeling I used to have waking up with a hangover back in my 20s. I'd lie in bed waiting for the bed to stop spinning, wondering why I ever thought 7 cocktails was a good idea, feeling that same pit of oddness in my belly, in my gut. And I'd wait, every synapse on patrol, we're on high alert, soldier, this is not a drill, for the wave of memory to wash over me, to spill over my brain in a cascade of shame as I remembered whatever crazy thing it was I'd done the night before. I slept with who? I cried where? I sang what song? This birthday morning, that's what it feels like, a hangover morning, except without all the bloaty puffy fun of the cocktails. I promised myself that I would do what? Downstairs, wearing a birthday hat made by the kids, I eat cake for breakfast. I consume almost the entire cake by myself, and I do not feel bad about it. That cake is everything to me. I want to have this cake's babies. I savor each bite. I am like a death row inmate having her last meal. In a text to one of my closest friends that day, I write the following. I'm going to say yes to anything and everything that scares me for a whole year, or until I get scared to death and you have to bury me. Ugh. My friend writes back, holy crap. I am not enthusiastic, but I am determined. My logic is wildly simple. It goes like this. Saying no has gotten me here. Here sucks. Saying yes might be my way to someplace better. If not a way to someplace better, at least to someplace different. I didn't have a choice. I didn't want a choice. Once I saw the unhappiness, felt the unhappiness, recognized it and named it, well, just knowing about it made me itchy. Like itchy on the inside of my brain. Continuing to say no is not going to get me anywhere at all, and standing still was no longer an option. The itchy was too much. Besides, I'm not a person who can see a problem and not solve it. Before you start to praise me, and frankly, I don't see how you possibly could at this point, but just in case, I want to be clear. I know that I said I am not a person who can see a problem and not solve it. But I don't mean that in a heroic Rosa Parks refuses to give up her seat on the bus way. I mean it in a sad, controlled freak, the toast crust must be cut off to the same exact millimeter measurement every time way. Meaning I'm not easygoing about these things. That's not how I'm built. That's not how any type A obsessive workaholic control freak is built. Obviously. I'm a doer. I do. So, when I say I'm going to do something, I do it. When I say I'm going to do something, I really do it. I throw myself into it and I do my ass off. I do right up to the finish line, no matter what. No matter what. This is all made worse by the fact that I'm competitive. Not normal people competitive, not friendly competitive, scary, psychotic competitive. Never hand me a volleyball. Don't ask me to play a fun hand of cards. I have never heard of a casual round of Scrabble. We started a bake-off at Grey's Anatomy and I had to remove myself from the competition. Something about it maybe being kind of like workplace harassment when I forced my writing staff to bake in competition against one another. And maybe it was also not so good when I performed a touchdown dance during the medal ceremony while yelling, "In your face, bitches!" at whoever placed behind me. Like I said, I'm competitive. I'm not invited to anyone's game night. Look, I'm a person who goes all in. I lean in. I lean all the way in. I lean so far in that sometimes I'm lying down. Hell, I don't own Thursday nights for nothing. I tell you this so that you understand how big this yes for a year thing was for me. This year of yes thing was gigantic. This year of yes promise was a commitment, a binding contract between me and my greatest competitor and judge, me. Backing out would mean months of self-flagellation and plummeting self-esteem. I would talk about me like a dog. Things would get ugly. Also, honestly, I was just desperate. Something had to change. It had to. Because this couldn't be it, having it all. This could not possibly be what having it all was supposed to feel like. Could it? Because if it was, if this was what I spent all this time and energy working so hard for, If this was what the promised land looked like, what success felt like, was what I sacrificed for, I didn't even want to consider it. So, I wouldn't. I would not think about that. Instead, I would look ahead, take a deep breath, and just believe.